Hello, I'm Muriel, and I love true crime.
I'm Nick, and I am not a fan.
Thank you for joining us. Each week, I force Nick to listen to me tell him a story of a true crime. Welcome to Muriel's Murders. Today, we are bringing you part three of our three-part series on the Dorothea Puente case, requested by Maddie. In our last episode, I accused everyone of being dumb and wrong.
Which was a great way to end it, by the way.
This episode, we discover just how right I was. Just kidding.
Probably not, though.
This week, we pick up where we began with the discovery of the first body in Dorothea Puente's front yard and her extremely easy escape from law enforcement. And then we'll continue on. through her time on the run, capture, and the very strange result of her trial. And then finally, that holiday surprise I've been teasing. I got Nick pretty good, you guys.
Yeah, we have already recorded that part, but I'm going to let it be a surprise for you. It was good. I think you delivered on the expectation. I was like, what is this going to be? We recorded it last night. It was great.
All right. For our sources, we used the excellent book Disturbed Ground by Carla Morton. We used the case text, I don't know, file.
Yeah, what is that? You're saying case text. You've been saying that this whole time. That's just the transcript from the courts, or what is that?
Yeah, case text is this awesome website that summarizes different famous trials, and they'll have like the court judgments. A lot of the times it's like the appeals that from famous judgments. Okay. And then they'll go through and like summarize the entire court case, and then you can go through and find quotes from the trial and stuff like that.
It's sort of like the court transcript for dummies or something.
I don't know.
It's like the footnotes version of it.
I don't know how to explain.
Okay, we're just
moving on. You're
gonna
have to look at it. Okay, it's interesting. It's a very good resource. The Life and Deaths of Dorothea Puente by Martin Coos for Sacktown Magazine, and then extensive reporting from the Sacramento Bee.
Hell yeah! All right, well, Christmas did come a little early this year. Santa Claus shimmied on down our chimney in the form of Rania signing up for our Patreon.
Yeah.
You guys don't understand. Like, we put on this podcast. People like you, brilliant geniuses, find us through the miracles of whatever this human existence is.
It's the internet.
And then, right, the internet. But then also, there's a million things on the internet, you know, and you find us.
Yeah.
And then some of you go ahead, like Rania, and sign up for Patreon. You sign up for the Spotify exclusive. We get a little email notification. Boom. Makes our whole day brighter. Santa Claus is coming to town. Have yourself a merry little Christmas. Now, I know those two lyrics aren't from the same song, but I just threw them together. Okay, be like Rania and sign up today.
Yeah, and if you do, you get all of these episodes all at the same time so you can binge super hard. So we're going to drop all of these on our Patreons or our Spotify exclusive feed. And then as soon as you're done binging these, which they're going to be great. Wait, this is episode 3, so you already listened to
this. Yeah, right. That's okay. I'm with you.
This sucks.
It's okay.
Well, guess what?
What?
If you're listening to this right now,
yeah,
and you're like, oh man, I did all that, there's also like a bunch of exclusive extra episodes.
Yeah, there's so much good material just waiting to be unlocked on Patreon.
I'm so dumb. All
no,
right, this
you're
is
pretty
a
good.
True story involving murder, violence, drugs, adult themes, etc. So if any listeners are like Nick and they don't want to hear about that kind of thing, please consider listening to a different podcast.
And we are true to life human beings who make jokes and say swear words, and if you don't like those things, turn us off.
All right, Nikki, are you ready to hear this story?
No!
Okay, let's get started. On November 10th, 1988, street counselor Judy Moyes was just about at her breaking point. Her longtime friend and client, Bert Montoya, was missing, allegedly somewhere near Utah after a long, mysterious stint in Mexico. Judy had managed to file a missing persons report, but the detectives working Bert's case wouldn't return any of her calls. Judy was slowly realizing the possibility that Bert's saintly landlady and caretaker, Dorothea Puente, could actually be some sort of monstrous shithead. And despite all the red flags Judy could see piling up around her, she was getting the impression her friends and coworkers all thought she was being histrionic, that she was inventing some dramatic scenario. Like, yeah, Judy, Dorothea Puente lost Bert in Mexico and hired some guy to pretend to be his brother-in-law from Utah. And we should all pay attention to her boarder who says she's burying bodies in the backyard. Like, girl, do you hear yourself, right? But she kept pushing for a meeting with investigators, even threatening to call her congressman. And eventually she got a meeting scheduled for November 11th. Then, 3 days after Judy reported Bert missing to police on November 10th, she got the world's most ridiculous letter from Bert's supposed brother-in-law who couldn't even pronounce his own first name.
Yeah.
So I just had to add this little piece. You know, it's not critical to the story, but I wanted to tell you. All right. So this letter came wrapped in a paper towel for some reason. And obviously, apparently later it came out in interviews that Dorothea Puente told the gentleman writing this paper, this letter, who ended up not being Bert Montoya's brother-in-law, but one of the convicts that was digging holes in her backyard, that wrapping in a paper towel would help them all avoid fingerprints.
Okay. She probably thought that was true.
Yeah, I'm sure she did. So the letter came wrapped in a paper towel and obviously seemed intended to cover any weak spots in the Utah story. It read, quote, "As I told you on the phone, Alvaro, Bert, as you know him, Jose, as we in the family call him, until he was told he was going to have to move again after the holidays and he did not want. He liked Dorothea and she took care of him like a mom. As you know, she has difficulty with the law, which she also told us about. What Jose did not tell you was he had called here at our home for the last 3.5 years. When we get settled, we will send you photos and we will let him call you about Thanksgiving if he wants to. Yours truly, Michelle Miguel Obregon."
A.K.A. Don Anthony.
Brilliantly covering for any previous misunderstandings regarding his first name. Apparently, he had two.
Yes.
Dorothea, don't do it.
She's already been doing it for so long.
The next day, November 11th, Judy Moise and her partner Beth finally got an audience with Detective John Cabrera, who was the person running the missing persons case.
Was he the one that showed up to the house?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And he was side-eyeing Judy from the beginning. Cabrera was suspicious. Like, he didn't know if Judy was actually worried enough to be threatening to call a congressman. He didn't know if she was trying to just do some, like, political pot stirring. He really didn't know what this chick was all about, right?
Right.
So Detective Cabrera at this point in the investigation was actually so suspicious of Judy's motive that before the meeting, he held both Judy and her partner Beth in a room for half an hour and taped their conversation so he could gauge whether they were actually genuinely concerned about Bert Montoya. Mm-hmm. So that's how skeptical he was of Judy and kind of how lukewarm he was at that point about whether or not, like, Bert Montoya's case was actually legitimate, really.
Right, right.
So through this recording, Detective Cabrera decided that Judy was freaked out enough, okay, for his liking. So he decided to go ahead with this meeting. And this part's a little confusing to me, just based on the book and some of the stuff I read. But I think this is what was going on. So I think Detective Cabrera was aware of Dorothea Puente's record, and he was aware of the terms of her parole, you know, but just that summer, though, she had been evaluated by a community care licensing agent and determined not to be running an unlicensed boarding house. So officially,
yeah, she was not in violation.
She wasn't in violation of her parole, and there were no complaints against her, right? People like Bert Montoya disappeared all the time. So Detective Cabrera really had no reason at all to arrest Dorothea Puente. And really, based on what they had on paper, Judy Moyse was looking a little wacky, mm-hmm. right? But if Judy Moyse's story was correct, and John Sharp, the tenant who passed police the envelope with the desperate note, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And told his story about like the tenants disappearing and holes being dug in the backyard. If he was telling the truth, then Dorothea was clearly in violation of her parole, right? Yeah. She was boarding people, right. Boarding, you know, obviously John Sharp, obviously Bert Montoya. She was having her fingers in people's social security checks. She was definitely violating her parole. So I think Detective Cabrera decided to hear Judy Moyse out, you know, to see if it felt legitimate and to see if anything clicked into place. So Judy sat down and she told him all about the letter wrapped in the paper towel and her theory about Dorothea hiring someone to pose as Bert's brother-in-law and her concerns about the trip to Mexico. She felt like that was the craziest thing going on in her life right now.
Yeah. I mean, but that's, she thinks there actually was a trip to Mexico. I mean, I think there definitely wasn't.
Yes.
But she thinks there definitely was.
Yes. So Judy went into the meeting really holding on to the hope that this was truly a missing persons case, that Bert was just lost somewhere. And she even came prepared for this meeting with images of Bert to make missing persons posters, thinking that that would be the next step in this meeting.
Yeah.
But instead of making a plan to find Bert, Judy had to listen to Detective Cabrera explain what those veteran social workers couldn't quite get across to Judy months earlier. Detective Cabrera methodically confirmed and explained all of Dorothea Puente's felony convictions from 1978 and 1982. The check stealing, the forgeries, the druggings, robberies, although he did not mention the fact that the police department had been warned about Dorothea stealing checks currently. Also that one chick who told them she was murdering people and hiding their bodies months earlier.
He didn't say all that.
He did not say that, but he did say, yes, she has. This is her background.
Yes.
And it hadn't really been their original intention, but after meeting with Judy Moyse, Detective Cabrera and his crew decided to go to Dorothea Puente's house with her parole officer that morning, charge her with violating her parole, and just kind of see what they could find. At that point, they didn't really have a warrant.
How had the parole officer not done that already?
Well, she really tricked him. Like, federal parole officers had been to that place like a dozen times. And they all thought she wasn't running a boarding house.
But were they also like, why are you pretending to be 75? They know who she is.
No, they just thought like, you're so charming. Like they really up to this point.
I'm sorry. If you're 50 years old and you're pretending to the world that you're 75.
She was like, but I know. It was a lot. It was a lot.
You know she's pretending her whole ethnicity and everything and a fake identity?
Nobody really, like, knew. Her last name was Montalvo on all those charges. So they kind of, like, people were like, I don't know, maybe. You know, it was really a different time. So they decide to go to her house, see what they could find. And based on John Sharp's story about his time at the boarding house, the crew opted to bring a few shovels just in case. One officer decided to be cute and even threw on a button that read, quote, I dig Sacramento.
Man.
Judy Moist and Beth. I know, it's just a lot. Well, also like previous to this, I'm not going to get way into this, but previous to this, there was also another serial killer within like the past couple of years that also had buried a bunch of people in Sacramento.
Someone had that freaking, those buttons made up.
Judy Moist and Beth left the ominous scene and headed back to the VOA office just to wait. And so we arrive at the beginning. That morning, Detective Cabrera's crew found the first body in Dorothea's garden. The next morning, Detective Cabrera personally escorted Dorothea Puente under the police tape and through the crowd of gathered press so she could have a nice cup of coffee at the Clarion Hotel down the street and soothe her nerves. If you look at photos from that particular moment in time as she's ducking under the police tape, you can literally see her purse bulging with $3,000 in cash. Dorothea Puente disappeared that morning. And in the days she was on the run, police would recover 7 bodies from her garden, including the body of Bert Montoya.
Yeah, RIP. Yeah.
The bodies were all mummified and covered in lime. So the ID process was very slow. Eventually, investigators would find Ben Fink, Bert Montoya, Vera Faye Martin, Dorothy Miller, James Gallup, Betty Palmer, and Leona Carpenter were all buried in pretty much the same way, posed in like a fetal position, wrapped in layers of bed sheets, quilts, and plastic bags, with the layers held together with duct tape and twine or different types of rope, and then very intricate knotting, particularly around the neck and behind the head. Many of the victims also had adult diapers and plastic sheeting plastered onto their faces. 6 of the bodies showed no trauma whatsoever, all except for the most decomposed victim, Betty Palmer. Her head, hands, and lower legs had all been severed and removed. Mm. The toxicology part is just like so complicated. I'm going to try to like really condense this down from, I don't know, 80 pages to 5 sentences.
Okay.
But from what I understand, all 7 of the bodies tested positive for sleep aids, benzos, hypnotic sedatives, or Benadryl. All of these drugs would have been sedating, especially when mixed with alcohol. And most of these people had, you know, issues with alcohol use.
Yeah. And it seems like she wasn't trying to make a no drinking rule. She was like, yeah, go to the bar next door. Like,
oh, yeah. She actively had a huge encouraging drinking. Liquor cabinet. Yeah. But none of the victims had taken the drugs in quantities enough to overdose on. And in addition, all of the drugs in their systems were types of drugs that are relatively hard to overdose on. Like, you would have to take a lot in order to overdose. Mm-hmm. All that to say is that the theory was that all of the victims were sedated in some way, but based on how the drugs are metabolized in the body, I guess that's up for debate for some experts. So they say, like, you know, we don't know the degree to which they were sedated.
So it sounds like what she was doing is waiting for them to pass out and then wrap plastic around their faces and do these intricate knots, and then they would suffocate to death.
That is essentially what the prosecutors say at trial happened. And we'll kind of get more into that.
So sadistic and evil and horrible. Intricate knots.
And there's arguments against it. But that's kind of like the argument.
Mm-hmm.
That's
what it sounds like just based on the things you just told me.
Right. Yeah. But that's, there are arguments against it. There are arguments for it. But that's how they found the bodies.
Mm-hmm.
On November 16th, 4 days after fleeing her boarding house, Dorothea Puente walked into a crappy dive bar in downtown Los Angeles wearing the exact same outfit she wore the day she left Sacramento. Uh-huh. A pink dress, red coat, long red coat, purple pumps, and plopped down at the bar next to an elderly barfly named Chuck. While everyone was untangling this horror show in Sacramento, Dorothea Puente had completely gotten away scot-free and made it down to Los Angeles. No one really knows why she didn't just go all the way south to Mexico. She had the cash. She had a jump on law enforcement. But for whatever reason, Dorothea decided to hole up at the Royal Viking Motel for 3 days, paying in cash and lurking in the dark. But on the third day, she got bored. I think being a pathological liar isn't fun if you don't have anybody to talk to, right? Uh-huh. So on November 16th, Dorothea went out to the dingy strip mall by the hotel to get a drink. And she introduced herself to Chuck Willigues as Donna Johansson.
Oh, man. For a minute there, I was invented in a whole narrative where the Chuck is Charles Bukowski.
That's amazing.
Who's definitely getting trash in L.A. at dive bars at the time.
So she told him all about how her luggage had been stolen and she was stuck at this awful cheap motel. And Chuck was starstruck. Donna looked so glamorous to him. He was a recent widow and lonely. And while he was a little weirded out by her, he was also drawn to her crazy, like a moth to a blowtorch. And Dorothea sat her weird, evil ass there in the outfit on the front page of every newspaper in the country and grilled this man about his social security benefits checks, told him about her dream to open a boarding house someday. And then after they got good and drunk, she offered him to cook him Thanksgiving dinner. And then if that went really well, maybe they could get an apartment together. And Chuck was like, whoa, whoa, whoa. Let's slow down, but actually let me get your number though. Okay. So they made a date for the next day. Okay. Yeah, uh-huh. And Chuck put Donna Johansson in a cab and floated home on a love cloud. And when he got back to his slummy apartment, he realized, wait a minute, that's that murder lady I saw on the TV.
Oh, thank God. Well, I guess we know all this because he survived.
Mm-hmm. Okay, good. But so this is actually really how this next part went down. Okay. You ready for this?
Yes.
So Chuck really still wanted this date with Dorothea. Okay. And he was worried if he was wrong and called the police, she'd dump him. So instead, he decided to call CBS News.
Oh, hell yeah.
And when Chuck was like, yeah, I think I just had drinks with that murdering landlady from Sacramento, they patched him straight to news assignment editor Gene Silver. And again, it's pre-internet days. So this guy for sure, like, doesn't have a fax or anything. Chuck doesn't have a fax.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Chuck is on the phone with Gene Silver going, I think it's Dorothea Puente, but I'm not sure. Do you have like a picture? Can you describe her for me? And Gene's like, sure, man. And takes 20 minutes trying to describe her from a photograph. And Chuck still can't decide. And by then, the 8 p.m. news is about to start. And so Gene Silver's like, just hang out and watch the 8 o'clock news, man. Her photo's going to be up there. And so he's like, stay on the phone and we'll just watch it together. So they just chill and watch the 8 o'clock news together.
On the phone, just being friends?
Yeah. And then it's like the one time they don't show her photo, they just show photos of the boarding house.
Oh, no.
So Gene is thinking, okay, well, this is the scoop of my career. So he decides to drive to Chuck's apartment with a photo of Dorothea, So this fancy editor dude shows up in the dark at Chuck's apartment complex. There's people doing crack in the doorway. It was a total scene. And Gene Silver, he went upstairs and gave Chuck the photo. And Chuck, he's like humming and sighing. And he says, well, you know, it looks a lot like her, but she's not. It's not the same dress. I'd have to see a color picture. And Gene Silver was already in it. So he crashed on the couch with Chuck and he just waited for the 9 o'clock news.
To see the news will be on again.
To see if there'd be a photo. And 9 p.m. rolls around and there's Dorothea Puente in full color in the outfit she was wearing at the bar, red coat and all. And Chuck is like, well, the bottom of the photo is cropped out.
Oh, my God, Chuck.
So I can't tell for sure if it's really the same dress. And by now, it's obvious Chuck just really wanted to go on this date.
Yeah.
So eventually, Gene Silver convinced Chuck to just go to the police. He just promised, hey, man, we just won't tell Dorothea that you're the rat, okay? So that way, if it's a mistake, you'll be in the clear. And even with that assurance, Chuck tried to talk them into waiting a day to arrest her just so he could still have the date, like, regardless of who she was. And they were like, no.
Well, it seems like at this point, Gene Silver could
have. He's going to end up with an adult diaper on his face in some grave somewhere.
Well, it seems like this journalist guy could have gone to the bar that they met at, shown pictures there. He could also be like, where did you send the cab to? Like, who is this woman? Like, you have her number, call her and say, like, actually, I want to see you now.
No, man. But he didn't.
He didn't do anything.
This is really how it went down. So
Gene Silver's just like leaving out the part where he was like, well, I didn't think it was good, but when I realized what apartment was, I was like, I could probably smoke some crack while I'm there.
It's the 80s,
smoking
man.
Crack this whole time.
So police found Dorothea at the Royal Viking Inn the next morning, and that was the end of the line. Dorothea couldn't really talk her way out of that one. It was pretty anticlimactic. They just asked her for ID and she handed it over, and it said Dorothea Puente of the Dorothea Murder House. Uh-huh. That was it. By now, this was a huge national story, and people with connections to Dorothea Puente started calling into Sacramento police. One of them being Everson Gilmouth's sister Reba in Sweet Home, Oregon. So we talked about Everson Gilmouth way back in part one. And Everson was, if you remember, he's the elderly man with the red pickup truck who liked to carve stuff out of wood and write letters to women in prison.
Yes.
And he disappeared after supposedly marrying Dorothea after she was released from prison.
Yes.
Right. And then his body was found near the San Diego River and held as a John Doe.
Right.
So Dorothea wrote Everson's sister Reba like a series of strange letters after his disappearance.
And then a new fake wife that said like, oh, we're happy, bye.
Yeah, right, exactly. So Reba hadn't heard from her brother in years. And when she saw Dorothea Puente's story on the news, she called police in Sacramento to tell them about her brother Everson. So using records from the sale of Everson or the transfer of Everson Gilmouth's red pickup truck from the transfer of the title, police were able to track down the handyman who built Dorothea a coffin-sized storage box back in 1985 and then help her dump it on the side of the San Diego River years earlier after she had supposedly filled it with 300 pounds of trash and nailed it shut right around the time Everson Gilmouth disappeared.
Yeah.
Well, that handyman guy got a sweet plea deal in exchange for his story. And then pretty soon, the coroner from Sutter County, California, who, you know, was the one who found the mysterious John Doe in a wooden box in a fetal position with no trauma to his body, wrapped up in layers of sheet and plastic like a mummy with meticulous knots up around his neck and head, caught wind of what was going down in Sacramento. And he joined the party, and by late 1988, Everson Gilmouth was named Dorothea Puente's eighth victim.
R.I.P.
But we're not finished yet. Back in November 1988, during the excavation of the bodies, there were crowds of people crushed into Dorothea Puente's front yard, trying to rubberneck their way into history. And one woman approached an ombudsman working the scene to tell him about her friend Ruth Monroe. Years earlier, in the weeks before Dorothea Puente was arrested back in 1982 and sent to prison, years before she even met Everson Gilmouth, there was a death in the back bedroom of that blue and white Victorian on F Street. The first death we know of that happened in the room Dorothea used to tell folks was haunted. Mm-hmm. Another death that Dorothea Puente has never been convicted of, the death of Ruth Monroe. So Dorothea knew Howard Monroe from the Sacramento bar scene. He was an alcoholic and an old barfly, and his new wife, Ruth, was a retired pharmacy worker. She wasn't a drinker, but the couple really liked Howard's social scene and hit it off with Dorothea Puente like gangbusters. So the three of them were like talking and drinking. And one night in late 1981, after Dorothea had jump-started her new career as a home caretaker who drugged and robbed her clients, like right in the beginning of that, the trio was hanging out in the Round Corner Tavern in the neon lights and the smoke when Dorothea started pitching Ruth on a fantastic business venture, taking over the Round Corner Tavern's kitchen lease. The bar was looking for someone to pay to lease out the kitchen, serve up burgers or whatever, and then keep the profits for themselves. And Ruth was getting antsy with her early retirement. And she was like 61. And it was a natural partnership. Dorothea had tons of kitchen experience, but no car. And Ruth had a car and startup capital. So Ruth pulled out cash for the lease and handed it over to her new best friend. And the suck fest started.
Suck fest?
Dorothea kept saying she needed more money.
Oh, money suckage.
Ruth sunk thousands into the venture. And then Ruth's new husband, Howard Monroe, was diagnosed with terminal cancer. By early April, Howard went into hospice. The restaurant flopped and the girls were forced to end the lease. With heavy losses from the restaurant venture and Howard's mounting medical bills, Ruth decided to file for divorce and to try and like protect her assets. And Ruth was lonely and trying to find ways to cut costs. So Dorothea offered her second bedroom. It was way cheaper than paying for an entire place on her own. And by then the women were very close. So friends and family say at the time, despite all of this terrible stuff, Ruth was pretty upbeat at the time. She was kind of looking forward to having a roommate. She was regularly visiting Howard at the hospital. She had lots of friends. She had five kids from a previous marriage, and four of them were local. So she had about 20 grandkids running around. She was prescribed a mild tranquilizer to deal with all the stress at the time, but like,
that makes sense. Who isn't?
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, I'll take one right now.
About a week after moving in with Dorothea, Ruth went to her weekly beauty parlor appointment with a friend and really upset everyone. She looked absolutely terrible. She was sickly, washed out, and at this appointment, she turned to her friend and she said, "I'm so sick, I feel like I'm going to die." So that same night, Ruth's son William visited her at the house on F Street, and he said she looked wiped out and uncharacteristically was drinking a glass of creme de menthe, like a liqueur. And his mom never drank alcohol, but she said Dorothea had given it to her to calm her nerves. And then 2 days later, her son William came to visit again. And this time, Dorothea stood in her little antique-filled living room and tried to physically block William from going to the back bedroom. Dorothea had this whole story about how Howard Monroe had been calling from the hospital, harassing Ruth, and she was so upset that Dorothea had to call a doctor. And Dorothea told William, quote, "The doctor was just here and gave her a shot. She's sleeping. Let her sleep." William pushed through this granny blockade and went into the back bedroom and found his mom lying in bed. He thought she was sleeping, but when he rolled her over, her eyes were wide open and she was staring at him and she seemed to be kind of tearing up. She didn't say anything, and William, believing Dorothea was a legitimate nurse, trusted the process and left his mother there to rest. Ruth's daughter, Rosemary, visited the home later that night as well, so just a few hours later. She was worried her mom had been acting like she was in a trance or kind of like catatonic the last few days. And it was the same thing. Dorothea told Rosemary she had taken Ruth to the ER to get a tranquilizer shot and just to leave her be and let her rest. And Rosemary, again, she pushed through and she went to the back bedroom to hug and kiss her mother and to check her pulse. And she found her mother was alive, but, you know, there was some suspicion there, right? But Rosemary, like her brother, she decided to trust the situation and left for the night as well. And then early the next morning, Dorothea called Rosemary to let her know her mother was dead.
Ugh.
Dorothea told police Ruth had a heart condition and had been experiencing chest and arm pains for the last few nights. And she also told police Ruth had been very depressed about her husband Howard's cancer and how he had been contesting their divorce and really hinting at suicide. When Ruth's children, William and Rosemary, brought up the shot Ruth was given, Dorothea, you know, pulled police aside and she told the police the kids were just really confused. There was no doctor. She had just been talking about a shot of alcohol to steady Ruth's nerves. And there was no official record of Ruth having any medical attention that night at an ER or otherwise. Toxicology results showed lethal levels of Tylenol and codeine in Ruth's blood, and then a very small dosage of the tranquilizer she had been prescribed. Her official cause of death was respiratory depression caused by a massive overdose of codeine. Ruth had passed away about 4 hours after her daughter Rosemary's visit the night before. Ruth's liver showed signs of necrosis. So it was like cell death. Her liver was dying, most likely caused by lethal doses of Tylenol taken over and over again over a period of 2 to 7 days. And by the way, there was no alcohol at all detected in Ruth's blood.
So that creme de menthe was just cough syrup.
Apparently. Her death was assumed to be a suicide and classed as undetermined. So they just assumed that she had taken the incredible, like incredibly painful route of poisoning yourself with like Tylenol. After Ruth's death, her kids found out her joint business account held with Dorothea had been drained of thousands of dollars and her jewelry was missing. When they confronted Dorothea, all she said was she didn't know anything about it and her best friend Ruth still owed her a lot of money. So she was really a victim in all of this. Mm-hmm. 3 weeks later, Dorothea was arrested for drugging and robbing 4 elderly people and sentenced to 5 years in prison under a plea bargain. Despite her children's suspicions, there was no serious investigation into Ruth Monroe's death at the time.
Even though it was right in the exact same time frame.
Even after Dorothea's conviction in 1982, investigators upheld their determination that Ruth died by suicide. Years after the 7 bodies were found on Dorothea Puente's property, Ruth Monroe's son, William, told Martin Coos from Sacktown Magazine, quote, "If she had been held accountable for murdering my mother, then maybe there wouldn't have been any other victims."
It's true. 100% true.
Ruth Monroe became the final victim attributed to Dorothea Puente. And on March 29th, 1989, Dorothea was charged with 9 counts of murder. The public was outraged at how catastrophically the system failed to protect Dorothea Puente's victims, of course, right? But there really wasn't an agency willing to take the blame. Everyone, the parole board, Social Security, the police, community care licensing, you know, the agency that decided it was okay Dorothea didn't have a license to run a boarding house. They all felt they had done their job correctly with the information they had at the time. In the end, street counselor Peggy Nickerson from St. Paul's took the fall.
Oh, really?
If we remember from the last episode, when concerned social workers sent a community care licensing agent to interview Dorothea, Dorothea ran a snow job, tricked her into believing she wasn't running a boarding house. But yeah, the agent did do her due diligence and double check with Peggy Nickerson to make sure.
And Peggy lied.
Right. Since everyone knew Peggy Nickerson had sent close to 20 people to Dorothea over the year. And Peggy Nickerson lied. She did it thinking she was riding in on a white horse, saving an amazing treasure of an unlicensed boarding house from being shut down. And she lied and said Dorothea was just hosting a crash pad and using her own money to give people a place to stay for a night or two in an emergency. There was no boarding house.
Right, because the big difference there would be a boarding house. These people are paying her rent.
Right. And she was staying and staying for a long time.
And staying for a long time. Right. But the she's like, she's not charging them. They just stay there.
And leave after a day, right?
Right.
Peggy was on record lying to the agent, and even though most of the nine victims were already dead by the time that Peggy gave this interview, she was blamed for the systemic failures of, you know, the whole debacle, right? Yeah,
I mean, that's not fair. No. But she did.
She did lie.
She did lie.
She was blamed for all of that and fired from her job. I think arguably this was a pretty hard case to prosecute from the beginning based on what I've read and based on disturbed ground. We're not going to get too deep into it, but from my understanding, here's how it went down. The original district attorney prosecuting the case filed the charges and took the whole thing through the preliminary trial, and then he quit. And it was a huge case. There were nine murder charges to prove, something like 280 witnesses to subpoena, and a whole lot of circumstantial evidence. A new DA took over, which put the prosecution at this huge disadvantage. It meant Dorothea's defense team had been working the case for 2 years, and the new DA was starting from scratch. And then the trial kept getting pushed back, which when you have all these elderly witnesses and witnesses with health problems and like unhoused witnesses, it's not great. Key witnesses disappeared, passed away, or became like really unreliable. And by the time the trial rolled around, all of Dorothea's 1982 victims had died, which were kind of like crucial to piecing together the whole case that involved Ruth Monroe, for instance. Mm-hmm. And the new prosecutor, John O'Mara, was just kind of holding things together by the skin of his teeth. So the trial started in February 1993, 5 years after Dorothea Puente's initial arrest. So, you know how we like to cover trials? Fast and loose, just how Nick likes it. In a nutshell, the prosecution's position was obviously she did it.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. You saw the same patterns emerge over and over again. These like made up stories about, oh yeah, he went up north, going to Utah, going to rehab, going back to Oregon, you know, writing fake letters to family, the stealing of the security, social security checks, obviously, the way the bodies were wrapped and buried, you know, similar sedating drugs in their system. I read the summary of the prosecution's opening statement a few times. That's about all I got out of it. I just couldn't really figure out how to. I feel like it's just like, yeah, obviously they did it, right?
Yeah. And yeah, she methodically lied and continued to collect money after people had disappeared.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Yeah.
That and the other thing that, you know, the prosecution sort of brought up was that the motive wasn't just money. It was also convenience, right? That Dorothea purposely sought out people in bad health, right? People that really needed her and maybe had some confusion, right? And then when she easily took over their money, she was stuck with them, forced to run what essentially was a skilled nursing facility. Mm-hmm. But she had a lot of those things in place to be able to pull it off. You know, she had she could do it. Mm-hmm. You know, she was capable of doing it to some degree.
What does that have to do with anything? Sorry.
Well, she didn't have to kill them to keep taking their money. It was sustainable. You know, she was in control of all of their money. So uh-huh. she could have kept taking it and kept them alive.
Right.
But she just killed
She's
them.
She's like, it's way easier for you to be dead than it is for you to be alive and me take care of
you. Yeah, it made life a lot less annoying. And then she could just collect the checks and not have to deal with it. And yeah. so that's the case that they put forward, which just makes her more evil. All right. I think the defense team's position just boiled down to Dorothea was Mother Teresa, who just liked to steal a bit. She had, quote, a touch of larceny in her heart. That's what one of them said.
Just a little kiss.
And maybe she buried people in her backyard, but that doesn't mean she killed them. So Dorothea's lawyers were clear. None of the evidence presented could prove definitively that any of the victims did not die of natural causes. All of the boarders were very chronically ill. They had liver damage, brain tumors, seizures, heart disease. You know, Bert Montoya was a diabetic. They easily could have died naturally. And when they did, Dorothea, who was so dedicated to her life helping the downtrodden, may have just quietly chucked their bodies in the yard. After all, if she reported their deaths, her boarding house would be exposed and she would be sent back to prison on a parole violation, leaving the world with one less caring home for the forgotten people of Sacramento.
The caring home, even if you follow that logic, what, the caring home that people just die? Like, maybe they wouldn't have died if it was in an actual caring home by their logic, I'm saying. You know what I'm saying?
So really, you know, burying people in the yard and keeping their government checks was actually an act of self-sacrifice.
Yes, yes.
And then the defense said, as for Ruth Monroe, that unfortunately was a clear case of suicide. Nothing changed from 1982 to now, so why would that case all of a sudden be prosecutable? You know, they were like, what, why would that change? And as for her late fiance, Everson Gilmouth, well, apparently he had died of a heart attack and she put him in a box full of toilet deodorizer and chucked him on some garbage by the side of a river so she wouldn't get her parole revoked. I think by then she had already started meddling with his Social Security benefits. And so like that would have been another way she would have gotten her parole revoked.
First of all, disposing of dead bodies.
Isn't that also a crime?
That's for sure a crime.
Yeah, right.
And she did it for 9 of them? She's going to be, I mean, that, to me, that you'd be sentenced to the rest of her. Oh, I guess she's only 58. I keep thinking she's actually old.
I mean, I don't really, you know, that's why we're who we are and not lawyers. So I'm sure there's some reason why that's. I kept being like, isn't this like tampering with a corpse or something?
Yeah, for sure.
I don't get it. All right, so we're just having fun out here, right? Talking about murders. All right, there are two highlights from the trial I'm going to hit you with, okay?
Okay.
The first is the jury was wacky as hell, all right? And I think this will factor in later. So I guess overall, the jury was just pretty out of control. They were whispering, laughing, making faces, making tons of side comments at the attorneys. Like, they would make a point and they'd be like, oh, yeah, you think that, would you? You know, like that kind of stuff.
You would say that, wouldn't he? He would, wouldn't he? Look at him.
They like to wear crazy outfits. They hung over the rails when they were bored. The ringleader of the group was this Vietnam vet who drove to court in a car with a vanity license plate that read extremist.
How is not every jury like this? I can't believe that juries hold it together at all.
One time, extremist got a bunch of the other jurors to come to court wearing sunglasses and like walk in like looking really cool. And another time,
This is the 80s. Extremist just meant like extremely rad.
I might have been, yeah. Another time, he just straight up fell asleep during one of the sessions and got yelled at.
He's extreme.
Everyone was afraid to tell them to cool it. And the judge didn't want to piss off the jury because the trial was just so long. You're talking about like 9, you know, murder cases. It was just so long. They were afraid of alienating the jury or like losing people on the jury because like nobody wants a mistrial, right? And at at points, the jury even took over court proceedings, apparently. Like, one time, the judge adjourned for the day, but the jury still wanted to know where the bar was in Los Angeles where Dorothea tried to seduce Chuck before she got arrested. So as everyone was filing out of the courtroom, the jury refused to leave their seats and were shouting, "Where's Tiny's bar?" And then, according to the book Disturbed Ground, they all started chanting, "K Street Mall! K Street Mall!" Which is where Tiny's bar is. Until they forced the court back in session. And the prosecutor had to go and set up his diagram again and show them where the bar was on the diagram.
Why did they want to know?
They just started, like, acting bad.
They're like, "What, you're going to keep us here all day, every day for months? Actually, we're keeping you here.
K Street Mall!"
Man, the one time that my worst experience with jury duty, I eventually got dismissed, but this judge was just such a hard ass, and she just wouldn't let, like, any of the single moms leave, any of the people that were like, "I already can't pay my rent from being gone, like, one day." And she was like, "You, like, literally wouldn't let anyone leave." I would love to see her deal with this kind of situation.
Yeah, they were really, real acting crazy. The other highlight I wanted to include was just this little bit from the court reporter, Mary Corbett, who had come down from Sacramento to work the trial. And she said one day on a break, Dorothea Puente turned to her out of nowhere and said, "How is your mother? I used to see her down at Frank's Meats. I always shop there because they have the best quality." And Mary said, "Oh, fine." You know, she smiled. And then later she said she was thinking about it. And she was like, "There's no way she could possibly know my mother." Mm-hmm. And she realized that at one point, really randomly in the trial, she had said something to the court clerk about Frank's Meats and her mom. And Dorothea had been listening and filed it away in her brain and was just waiting.
Yeah, well, it's what she does.
She was just waiting to strike, like a demented viper.
Like, well, she had to sit there and be quiet this whole time. She was like, "I need to lie to somebody.
Yeah.
When can I do it?"
How, like, weird. Like, I think that she had never even spoken to her. Like, "Hi, how are you? What's your name?"
No. If you're going to be a liar like this, you just have to do it. You do it compulsively. It's in your blood.
Yeah.
It drives you, and you don't even think about getting away with it or not. You just do it so pathologically, so religiously, that you don't even question it.
Yeah, it's like me correcting, like, my yours and theirs in texts. Ooh. All right. The trial dragged on months. To July 1993, so like a very long time, most of a year. In the closing arguments, the prosecution had a couple of zingers. One really effective moment was, you know, like trotting out the photographs of the autopsies. And based on these photographs, it really looked as if some of Dorothea's victims had been smothered. Uh-huh. You know, what the prosecution pointed out was being smothered wouldn't have really shown up in an autopsy after being buried for so long. Like, it wouldn't have shown up on these bodies. And if they were sedated and already drunk or weak from health issues when they were smothered, it wouldn't have been very physically hard to accomplish, right? So autopsy photographs showed five of the six victims with heads, R.I.P. Betty Palmer, were buried with plastic bags or adult diapers wrapped around their faces. So it really suggested a possible method of murder. And again, it's still circumstantial, right? Like, they can't determine whether or not those things were on before or after the person died. But it was very powerful moment. And finally, like to your point, you already said it, to address the point that Dorothea's alleged victims potentially died of natural causes, the prosecution pointed out it's also a crime to just let people die without intervention. Like, if she's such a great lady, why didn't she call an ambulance while these people were having health emergencies? Or I don't know, maybe get them actual medical help or get them into a skilled nursing facility before they died, instead of just like letting them waste away at her house.
Right.
Yeah, just exactly what you said. As for the defense, they landed on, hey man, it was a private cemetery for a weird lady who liked to steal, but it wasn't a murderer. And no one could prove otherwise based on the evidence provided. Mm-hmm. So that was in a nutshell what they wanted to say. So deliberation started July 15th, 1993. Two tense weeks passed. And the jury came back on August 2nd, deadlocked on all 9 counts, asking for further instruction. They were given more tactics and information and then like sent back to keep going at it. The judge was just like, please find a way to not be deadlocked on all 9 counts for the love of God, right? Mm-hmm. So weeks went by after that with no result, which often is a bad sign for the prosecution. If a quick return.
Yeah.
A lot of times, not all the time, but sometimes signals like a conviction.
Right.
Longer it goes, the worse.
I remember the Murdaugh one was like immediate.
Yeah. Like after it was like 45 minutes or something. Yeah. And actually deliberations in the Dorothy Puente trial were the longest murder trial deliberations in California history at the time. Mm-hmm. Eventually, by August 26th, the jury had their verdicts. They reached verdicts on 3 counts. 4 counts were hung and the other 2 counts were split. So a mistrial was declared on 6 of the 9 counts. These cases were never retried. So that meant Dorothea Puente was never convicted in the deaths of Burt Montoya, Everson Gilmouth, Ruth Monroe, James Gallup, Vera Faye Martin, or Betty Palmer. As for the murders of Leona Carpenter, Dorothy Miller, and Ben Fink, Dorothea Puente was declared guilty. So, it's kind of random. I know this is a lot of names, so we're just going to go over this a tiny bit. Okay. People understood the conviction on the murder of Ben Fink. So, I don't know if you remember him.
Yeah, he was the drunk. His brother, he would show up.
In the last episode, one of Dorothea's other boarders, John Sharp, practically heard his murder through the walls of the house and smelled the decomposition of his body in the upstairs bedroom, right? It was very clear in the timeline of his murder, right? But as for Leona Carpenter and Dorothy Miller, so little was known about them. It seems super weird that those were the only other convictions. So let's go back to this wacky jury, okay? They were all buddies wearing sunglasses until it came to deliberation time, and then they all started fighting. Well, really, it seemed like it was everyone versus one person, and surprisingly, it wasn't the extremist. The jury deadlocked on 6 counts of murder, mostly because of one holdout who just wanted to leave the whole thing up to a different jury. He just didn't want to have to make the decision. It was Jesus Sanchez, aka Jesse, a 33-year-old technical engineer. According to Wayne Wilson for the Sacramento Bee, some of the jurors thought Jesse Sanchez was very intelligent and impossible to communicate. Some thought he was super dumb. Most of them were pretty pissed about it, saying he like was holding the entire legal system hostage on technicalities. Others say he was just thorough. But what it all boiled down to is he just kept saying, I don't have enough information to make that decision. He was adamant about two things. They didn't have enough evidence. And for some reason, he was just like super hardcore about how pharmaceutical drugs couldn't be considered poison, which felt really pedantic to a lot of folks. Like they were just like, what?
Yeah, I mean, anything is poison if you do it too much in a way that you know will hurt someone.
Well, he was mad about that for some reason.
I mean, water, you can die from drinking too much water.
Go tell it to the choir. ultimately, after hot, sweaty fighting and role-playing and screaming, they were able to come to some agreement. Jesse Sanchez never made any public statements, but according to other jurors, you know, okay, other jurors say this, right? They all pretty much agreed on Ben Fink. John Sharp's testimony was convincing.
I was going to ask. He did testify.
He did, yeah. And the timeline of when and where Ben Fink was buried, the stench of the body, the complaints of the neighbors, it all painted a grossly clear picture.
Yeah.
As for Leona Carpenter, the jury was largely convinced by a theory thrown out by the prosecution. So it's kind of wild, but it fits the timeline of the evidence pretty well.
Are you going to, sorry, will you remind me her story? What were her?
I'm going to remind you okay. of all of it, okay? Okay? So this is just so you kind of can understand it. So Betty Palmer and Leona Carpenter were two of Dorothea's earliest victims from 1986 and 1987. So prosecutor John O'Mara's theory was this, that Dorothea murdered Betty Palmer in October 1986 and then got an ID card with her face and Betty Palmer's name so she could continue cashing Betty's checks. But Dorothea might have felt when she made this ID, she went too far and too fast, freaked out, dismembered, and decapitated Betty in an attempt to hide her identity and then buried her in the front yard. So this was like just one of the very earliest victims. Mm-hmm. Dorothea's next victim was Leona Carpenter. So Leona Carpenter was significantly ill. She was in and out of the hospital with overdoses and in desperate need of a skilled nursing facility. So this woman was the woman who Dorothea swooped into the hospital with a notary and got power of attorney over. So she came in, she got power of attorney over Leona and had all of her government checks set up for direct deposit into Dorothea's personal account by January 1st, 1987. So like within weeks of, you know, getting all this stuff signed over, she had total control over all of Leona's money. Then she brought Leona back to her home instead of bringing her to a skilled nursing facility, parked her on the couch, and told everyone she was Betty Palmer. So in the weeks leading up to Leona's death, Dorothea's other tenants didn't actually remember anyone named Leona. They could only remember a woman named Betty who was just lying on the couch, moaning, begging for pills, who was in and out of the hospital and disappeared sometime in February. So Leona was so sick and out of it, she never said anything. And Dorothea's other tenants just assumed Leona was Betty, just slowly deteriorating in health. And with this ruse, Dorothea was able to use Leona to cover up Betty's disappearance. And Leona was eventually found in a backyard grave with codeine and other sedatives in her system, drugs that had to have been administered by Dorothea, as Leona wasn't even able to use the bathroom by herself. So essentially, like, the idea is Betty Carpenter was one of the earliest victims. She killed her within a few weeks of her moving into the house, mm-hmm. tried to kind of like remove her identity and had this like overkill, like, you know, taking her head and her hands and everything like that. And then was like, wait, I can just get another lady to pose as her. And then sure. the next person she killed, she just kind of killed her and threw her in yeah. the backyard.
She was like, I'm killing these people to make my life easier, not harder.
Right. I was like, now, once she saw how easy it was to just like, nobody cared.
Yeah.
I think that's the idea. It's like, she was like, oh, I don't have to be so meticulous about it.
So heartbreaking.
Yeah. Anyway, that's the short version of the prosecution's theory. And all we know is after weeks of intense badgering, Jesse Sanchez refused to agree to vote guilty in the case of Betty Palmer, the woman who was decapitated, right? But for some reason, he was convinced to agree to vote guilty on one count of second-degree murder for Leona Carpenter. So that was what was so odd. Mm-hmm. He was convinced by that story, but not enough to convict on Betty Palmer, only for Leona Carpenter. And for the final conviction, I couldn't find anything super compelling about why Jesse Sanchez decided to convict in Dorothy Miller's case over anyone else. I don't know if you remember Dorothy Miller from the first one. She was a World War II veteran and an alcoholic with tons of health problems. And she only stayed with Dorothea for a brief time. Dorothea kept her locked in an upstairs room.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I remember.
So she was up there for a couple of weeks before she disappeared. And she was described as small and odd, paranoid, who avoided the other tenants. And her pension and benefits checks paid Dorothea's rent up until Dorothea was arrested in 1988.
Yeah.
But other than that, I couldn't figure out any reason why she would be more compelling than like Bert Montoya's story or anything like
totally.
That.
Totally, yeah.
So Ben Fink, Leona Carpenter, and Dorothy Miller, they were the only three counts Jesse Sanchez agreed to vote on. He wouldn't explain himself at all. And then after that, he was done. He said, that's all I'm going to give, and he refused to engage any further. On December 10th, 1993, Dorothea Puente was sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And just for the record, the same jury was supposed to vote on whether or not she would get life or death.
Uh-huh.
And they deadlocked on that as well.
Uh-huh. that just goes to life.
They were just like, we're doing life.
Okay.
And Dorothea Puente died in prison in 2011. According to the interview she did with Martin Kuss from Sacktown Magazine, while in prison, she really went off reinventing her life story. As of 2009, she said she was once a professional golfer on the LPGA tour, a Rockette, a game show winner, and certainly not a mass murderer. She said she had to quit working as a Rockette in New York City when in a freak heel breaking accident caused Dorothea and another dancer to fall into an orchestra pit. Dorothea broke
That's just clumsiness. That's just like, oh, so you were like a bad dancer.
Dorothea broke her leg and the other girl was paralyzed.
Oh no.
The Rockettes say there is no record of this ever happening.
It's like, no, we hire the best dancers in the world. They're not gonna like quote unquote break a heel and fall into the orchestra pit like it's a Three Stooges bit.
Now we're gonna conclude this story with our pre-recorded holiday surprise. Happy holidays, folks.
You know, also, look, I'm as a holiday gift, because there's going to be at least one person that's going to appreciate it. This next segment really does feel like a Hell in Your 30s, episode kind of. So I'm going to play the old school Hell in Your 30s theme song,
I love it.
Just for anyone out there who appreciates
an old school
that
fan.
Here we go.
Let's do yoga. Let's get fit. Let's do jumping jacks and we'll get rich. But oops, I found that bottle of gin underneath the sink again. So tomorrow's a new day. Let's order pizza.
All right, so I promised you a huge surprise, right?
Yes.
And
you got me drunk for this part. I don't know where. We were going to record the whole episode. Miro was like, all I need is 10 minutes, but you have to get drunk first. I was like, what are we doing? So here we go.
So we're tacking this on to the end.
Okay. So we've already recorded.
We've already recorded the whole episode, okay. But we're tacking this on to the end. Okay. Because it took me a really long time to get this all set up.
Uh-huh.
And now it's too late to record the main part of the episode.
Okay.
So, woo, here we go. Yeah, magic.
The magic is in the editing.
All right. So while in prison, mm-hmm. Dorothea Puente also released a cookbook with the help of author Shane Bugbee. Dorothea claims to have operated and owned several restaurants. And as a special surprise,
uh-huh.
I have prepared 3 of her famous Mexican dishes for you. We're going to have a tasting menu.
This is amazing.
It's going to be progressive.
Okay. We've been watching Top Chef, people.
We're going to start with a cold dish.
Okay.
That will be Dorothea's nacho plate.
Cold nachos?
That's Come how on. She serves them.
Authentic Mexican frigid nachos?
That's how she serves them.
Okay.
Then we'll be moving on to the Mexican chicken liver gizzard soup, which I've prepared for you. You walked in this morning from work and you said, oh my God, it smells so good. And I said, I made you a special dinner.
It really smelled good.
So get ready.
Uh-huh.
And we're going to be tasting it and talking about the notes and the textures. I have to say, I did laugh the entire time I made this one.
Okay.
And then we're going to finish the night off with some delicious, decadent Mexican chicken and charred calzones. So I've made everything for us.
Amazing.
They'll be coming out in a progression.
Yes.
I'm going to take a break really quickly and assemble our cold dish.
Okay, those nachos. I'll take extra ice on my nachos, please.
Just get ready.
I'm so ready.
Nick, what are you going to do?
I'm going to hold on to my butt. I really am. I'm holding on to each of the cheeks with all of my hands. It's really a lot of
butt holding. You know, it's not even a handful. All right, here we go.
Oh my God, you bought the whole cookbook?
I did. All right, so we're going to be starting with the Dorothea's nacho plate.
Did she just, it looks so gross.
So I want you to know
that
for each of these dishes, I made absolutely no adjustments. The only thing I did was I literally painstakingly went through and made the recipes much, much smaller. I reduced them all by to 1/4 of what they should be.
This really changes the whole narrative of like there's always a delicious pot of soup cooking on the thing, or like, ooh, breakfast at 5:30. She just didn't. That's just cold nachos. No, I'm looking at a plate of chips. Are those beans?
So I'm going to read you the ingredients. So we're going to, I'll tell you what.
Okay.
Sorry. I'm going to explain the dish like they do in Top Chef.
Ugh.
Stop. I'm going to explain the dish like we do in Top Chef. You're going to take a taste.
Okay.
And we're going to do some tasting notes. So I did all of the proportions exactly how she wanted them to be. I just reduced the size because we're not going to eat the size that they wanted.
I'm not even going to finish that. There's no way we're going to eat that.
You are being a monster and I know you.
You're right. I might eat a
bunch
of it. You
love it. And I know you're
hungry. Right. You're right. Never say that.
So don't try to be acting like you're not going to eat that. Get out of here. You're going to be like, let's heat that up. All right.
Oh, yeah. Heat it up. Okay. Anyway.
So Dorothea's nacho plate is a bed of, she calls them packaged nachos, which are tortilla chips. Okay. And then one small can of olives. Well, basically what you do is you do shredded cheddar cheese, pinto beans mashed with the juices.
Okay.
And then
as opposed to like a delicious can of refried beans.
Then you mince an entire small onion. And then, crazy twist, you mince an entire 1/4 cup of celery you put on top. You only can have 8 slices of jalapeno chilies.
Okay.
And then you put an entire small can of olives on top and they can be sliced. And the entire dish, you mix it together. I did layer it atop the bed.
It. Yeah.
But you're supposed to mix the whole thing together.
like a big salad.
Some of these instructions are not very clear. Like they don't give temperatures for ovens or things like that.
The funniest thing about this is if someone served you these nachos, you would look at it and say, are you a serial killer?
Yeah, you know what's so funny? Huh. We went to a place in Seattle. What was the place in... We went to go get nachos that my mom loves. That's like by her house that my dad gets the meatloaf.
Oh, Twilight Exit?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And they served green olives on the nachos. And I thought they were serial killers.
And besides that, it was literally amazingly delicious nachos with one little weird thing.
I was like, what a weird thing.
Like, you guys have to go to jail immediately.
So this has a, like, proportionally, a lot of celery. if you think about it.
Yeah.
Okay. So as much celery as black olives, just if you're thinking about that and picturing it. So anyways, that's more description than they usually give people in Top Chef. Please take a bite and enjoy.
Here we go. Oh, wow. It really is cold.
And make sure that you get a lot of celery and onion, because it's also a lot of onion.
Yeah, it's impossible to miss.
Well, I think this celery really complements the black olives.
The celery and black olives are the least offensive part of this whole thing. It just literally tastes like ice cold nachos. There's just nothing to it except for it just needs to be melted.
It's also like proportionally, there's not a lot of cheese.
The beans are really gross.
Yeah, mashed in their own juices. I have refried beans in the pantry, but I was like, what does cold pinto beans
without any additional seasoning or anything?
Yeah, what does it taste like?
No, it's really gross. The beans are the grossest part.
One thing you learn about Dorothea is that she does not like salt.
No. She doesn't like logic either.
No. Go ahead. If you were having a refreshing day outside.
Oh, yeah. Right. Like, these would be the nachos you'd want if it was like 112 degrees and you were like, I don't know, laying asphalt in Phoenix.
I'm going to be real right now.
But the thing is,
I don't hate the celery as much as I thought I
would. No, the celery is fine.
I thought it would be insane.
No. It's just crunchy and green at this point. That I'll take it. Okay. Yeah, no, by far the thing that makes that actually gross, are the beans.
Mashed in their own juices? You don't like that part?
And you know me, I'm a huge fan of mashing in someone's own juices.
I know.
I'll take some juices.
I'm going to say I'm giving that 3 out of 5 stars.
3 out of 5? In what context? Like 5 would be nachos you actually love?
I think, I don't know. Just wait till you try the soup. Hold on.
Oh, wow, there's a big chunk of celery poking out of this soup.
All right, so this is Mexican chicken gizzard livered soup. Dorothea said, this is her quote from the book, this is so good. My great-grandmother made this. Everybody from miles around used to come to eat it on a Sunday afternoon. Good for the morning after, from the night before. I made it for my people a lot for Sunday brunch. They loved it. So this particular soup takes... This particular soup takes 1 pound chicken gizzards.
Ugh.
Chicken gizzards aren't that bad.
They're not bad, but a pound of them.
It's a lot of.
That's like 30 chickens worth of gizzards, isn't it?
So
actually, is it a pound of gizzards?
It's a lot.
It's a lot, right?
So
am I wrong?
So for me, the technique is really where it gets you.
Can I start eating this?
No. We're just describing it.
Oh my God,
first.
Hurry up. I really want to put this in my mouth.
Okay, so. Pound chicken gizzards, zucchini, chicken livers.
There's huge and then, zucchini in this. Oh, that was your timer. You had a timer?
Oh, shoot. Yeah, good? Hold on 1 second.
Okay, pause. We're back.
Okay, so there are 4 celery ribs, 3 potatoes, 2 onions, and 6 carrots. And what she says with those, they're only peeled and quartered.
The carrots
and the celery and the onions. So everything is in huge
there's
pieces.
Definitely I have you gave us a little bowl, thank God. It's 90% 1/4 of celery and 1 gigantic chunk of zucchini,
huge chunks, which is really interesting to me.
And then only chunks of gizzards that can only be described.
You're not supposed to cut them. That's a whole heart.
That's a heart.
That's a chicken heart. You're not supposed to cut them. You're just supposed to rinse them up. That's a whole chicken liver.
That's a whole chicken liver? Well, I actually like liver.
I know. So you might really like this. You might really like it. And then there's eggs and egg noodles. I mean, I'm sorry. There's rice and egg noodles.
Okay.
And then canned tomatoes. And the thing is, she has you cook. So what you do is you boil the water and then you dump everything in at the same time. So the egg noodles and the rice go for like 2 hours, which is amazing. Because at the end, it becomes like a porridge.
I was going to say, there's literally no noodles in here.
Yeah, but there were at one point.
So here's my question.
Okay.
Did she actually, do you think
what
she actually ever cooked any of this, or while she was in jail, she just started making up more lies and inventing the way she always has her whole life and started saying things?
You know, I think that's a question that will be always and forever
unanswered.
Unanswered.
Uh-huh.
I mean,
who the hell is Shane Bugbee? What did he, is he like, why is he a co-author on this? Who's that guy?
You know, I'll say this. I read this book.
Uh-huh.
I didn't read it cover to cover, but I did read some of it. And he did something that you're not really supposed to do, which is he kind of like very slickly traded money for interviews. He did it by being like, oh, I can help you sell stuff if you help me get interviews with you. You know, like he's not, I don't know who this guy is.
Yeah.
What
are the quotes on the back of the book? It's like people giving credit to the, what is this? What are the like positive quotes from reviews?
The Sacramento Bee said in good taste and then a lot of, and then a lot of ellipses, excellent lady known for her stews, soups and puddings, but a lot of ellipses. The Sun says grand.
That's so funny. So there's literally nothing positive about that. It's just several words from their things with ellipses.
Mm-hmm. Grandmotherly Dora Thea Puente is becoming as renowned for her cooking, .. As for being a notorious mass murderer, .. Except for they said mass murder.
Okay.
So that's not great. Okay. And then an ex-tenant said, every dinner at Dorothea's was like Thanksgiving dinner. And then Dorothea said, none of them were murdered. They died of natural causes. I couldn't do that anyhow. I'm not that type of person. I'm too caring and I worry too much about my people eating. Everybody can tell you that. Why would I spend money fattening them up if I was going to kill them? And that's a big quote of the book.
Wow.
You know, it's pretty trashy. And also there's only like 15 recipes and most of them don't make sense.
I'm so sorry that I took, we have to eat this before it gets any colder. Like I feel like the only way this is going to be at all.
Okay. But you have to eat the heart and the liver.
Yeah, I'm going to.
Okay. Okay. First and then I'll you have to describe it. Okay. Try the broth.
Broth. Incredibly bland. Needs any amount of salt. I would take literally any amount of salt.
I think for having no salt, it's kind of got some flavor.
It tastes like all the things that are in it, like a can of tomatoes and noodles that have been disintegrated into.
The disintegrated noodles do have a snot-like texture, I have to say.
I think zucchini cooked that much is really gross. Let's try this liver.
Okay, liver.
Really gross. I can't believe I'm eating that.
Should I do it?
It's fine. Livers are okay. It needs salt, though, or like hot sauce.
Oh, my God. Oh, I can't eat that. I'm sorry.
I ate mine.
I can't eat it. I'm sorry. I can't eat it. I'm putting it on top of the zucchini.
Well, that huge log of zucchini there for you.
I can't do it.
I don't know if I can eat the heart.
No, dude. Try to eat it. The heart's going to be less gross than the liver.
I think so. It's smaller.
It's the smaller and won't be as mushy.
Oh, you're right. It's chewier.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it just tastes like nothing. There's literally no flavor.
Imagine eating this when you're hungover at brunch. At Dorothea Puente's house. I gotta say, I think the gizzard is the least terrible part.
Is the gizzard the heart?
Yeah, I think gizzard is like the heart and like the lungs or kidneys or something.
You know, I'm working at this restaurant right now and it's been around for 100 years and they're credited with introducing nachos to Los Angeles and all they are tortilla chips with cheese melted on top.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one, and people still
love
them.
You should see if they want to try it cold.
I know. You know, it's very common. People want them exceedingly well done with like tons of burnt black edges. People want that all the time.
Weird.
Okay, so there's that. Then mixed with that quote from Tina Fey or something at one point where she was just like, in the 80s, they learned about melting cheese on chips.
And yeah,
it was like
right.
this revelation for like whatever teenage sleepovers she was having or
yeah,
something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And there is a chance that she was making food this bland and absolutely terrible. And the people she was feeding were like, oh my God, thank you. The food's amazing. We love this food. I can absolutely imagine a world in which good home cooking is, frankly, at the time, you know, it was before Top Chef. Now everyone can just watch Food Network and learn a few tricks and make some good stuff. You know what I mean? And I could imagine the food being pretty bad and people being like, oh, thank God, this is great.
Mm-hmm. I think you're right. I mean, you know, and to each their own, man.
What if we throw up? Yeah, I can't eat that. That's so gross. I've never had zucchini less appetizing. I'm not even going to try to eat that celery.
Well, I followed it exactly to the letter. And it was really painstaking. I weighed everything out by the ounce on our food scale. And
you went to Trader Joe's and the guy was a jerk to you?
Yeah, but his console thing malfunctioned and didn't have to pay.
I know. Muriel said the guy, her chip was not working. And it kept saying, like, it wasn't working. And then the guy was like a hipster jerk. And Muriel's like, did this go through? And he goes, yeah, it went through. The receipt printed. And then she walked out the door and looked at the receipt and it just said customer copy and no.
Well, this guy and I have we have a history. Okay. Because he's really handsome and he doesn't like me. And I don't know why. I've only had him check me out twice. And one time he checked me out, meaning my groceries. And I was like, hey, man. And I was like, God, it's so crazy that it's so dark so early. I always forget that. Like, it still messes with me even after all this time or whatever. Because it's like wintertime.
Right. It's like 3 o'clock and getting dark.
Yeah. Something. Whatever. I was just like, had been podcasting all day and I just hadn't been outside. And he goes, yeah. Da, da, da. Like, I was so stupid. And I was like, oh, okay. And I was like, oh, I don't know. I just was like, yeah, you know, I'm from Seattle back then. And I just still was trying to be nice to him. And he was thinking I was so dumb. And then I went through his line again today and he was looked up, saw me and like basically rolled his eyes. And I was like, am I really that terrible? And I went through his line again and I stuck my card in to the console and it goes, thanks. And I take your card out and I took it out and it said, oh, you took your card out too soon. And I put it back in. And then it was like doing all these error messages. And I was like, oh, did it go? And he's like, yeah, your receipt's in your bag. And I was like, all right, dude, see you later. I got home and it was like, didn't go through. I was like, ha ha.
You douche.
I mean, it was like 12 bucks. I'm sure he doesn't care. But I was like, should I call Trader Joe's?
Well, one thing that's really, really, no, literally you should not. And also the other thing is everyone at that job is cool. Everyone who works at that store is cool.
I know, except for that guy. When I looked at the receipt, I go, okay, Kyle. Putting him on blast.
The progression is really, really good. I cannot wait to see what kind of thing happens next.
Okay, so this one I'm kind of excited to show you.
Hell yeah.
Okay, so here's the last one, okay?
Ready? Let's do it.
Okay.
Wow. Oh, the calzone. I forgot about the calzone. Did you make that dough?
Hell no, I got it at Trader Joe's for free, man.
Looks pretty damn good. That sauce really does not look seasoned.
I did exactly what she told me to do.
Of course you did.
So this one I really like because she calls it her classic Mexican, underlined, chicken and charred calzones.
And charred calzones.
This is a charred and chicken calzone.
What does charred and chicken mean? What do you mean by that?
Chard, like Swiss chard.
Oh.
Like the green.
Gotcha.
Okay, Swiss chard and chicken calzone.
That's not Italian or Mexican.
Oh, I know. And guess what the secret ingredient is? You get one guess.
Nutmeg.
Cottage cheese.
Oh, no.
So I love this because I don't think it's actually going to be terrible. But there's literally nothing Mexican in it whatsoever.
Or Italian.
Yeah. Well, she makes you put Italian seasoning in it.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. What kind?
Oregano and basil.
Wow.
And actually, she said put a little fennel in, so I did.
Oh, my God.
And there's some mozzarella. Uh-huh. And then she said...
Mozzarella and cottage cheese?
Yeah. And she said, put some garlic in there.
Oh. Uh-huh.
And use some frozen pizza dough and a cup of tomato sauce.
A cup of tomato sauce.
On the side for dipping.
This is like store-bought tomato, tomatoes, like spaghetti sauce.
Yeah.
Well, okay, well, there's probably some seasoning in it then. It's not just like pureed tomato.
No, I followed her instructions exactly. It's like a combination of store-bought stuff and whatever cottage cheese calzone. All right, go ahead. You go ahead and tell me what you think.
Okay, well, the cottage cheese is dripping.
What do you think of the
soggy bottoms for sure? The top looks great.
It doesn't have a soggy bottom.
Touch that.
Ooh, here, you take mine. I'll take that one.
That one's very soggy. Oh, you gave me the good one? Yeah. Oh, you're right. This part's only a little soggy. All right, here we go. I need that.
I think it's the most edible out of the three.
It definitely is. I mean... Honestly, frozen. So what? This is store bought frozen pizza dough.
It's a Trader Joe's one,
but it's frozen. Mm-mm. It's not bad. What is it? It's just pizza dough that comes in the bags as a ball or whatever, and you roll it out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it still needs a lot of seasoning.
And like, she doesn't want to put olive oil on it.
Is there chicken in there?
Yeah, she said brush. The calzone with minced olive oil, which I'm like, what are you talking about?
Minced olive oil?
I mean, minced garlic. There's no fat in it. Like, it needs, like, olive oil on top. And, like, salt. So it's just a dry-ass crust.
What, you just made one of these?
No, dude, I made four.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Is that what we're having for dinner tonight?
Hell yeah.
I'll eat this.
This is bomb.
I mean, it's completely stupid. And there's a million ways to make
it
better.
I think the cottage cheese works really well.
Cottage cheese is, don't think I could even tell you cottage cheese was in this.
No, this is, you know, this is a very totally like late 1980s calzone.
Well, we're recording this before, even though you guys are hearing it after the whole story. Recording it before, so I don't know what she was convicted of, but let me tell you, Dorothea officially killed it. Okay, boom. Are you guys happy you stuck around for that?
I've been thinking about getting older, and I've been worried about losing touch, and it gets lonesome hearing my feelings. But then I listen to Nick and Muriel, and I don't care so much, 'cause I know that all my friends are lovely, and I know that if we meet, I'll say the same about you. Someday we all pass, and the ones behind will raise a glass, and they'll cheers and have a laugh, looking back at what we used to do.
Thank you so much for listening.
Muriel did all the writing and hosting. I did all the editing and post-production and uploading. And you guys did all the listening.
All of it.
You really did 100% of the listening.
You did such a good job. We love you so much. We hope you have the best time. You guys, we'll make an announcement, but after this, we're going to take a cold-ass break for a little while.
I think this one, for anyone on the who's listening just on the free feed, I think this it might be 2024. when this episode comes out.
Yeah, we didn't
for
do
you?
A lot of good math, but
we don't
will.
Remember. Anyways, if it is, damn.
Happy New Year.
How's the future? Tell us. And then if you're listening now, then just like whatever. But like, you know, it's going to be 2024 soon. So we hope that goes well for you also.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, have a good rest of your year, man. We'll talk to you soon.
We love you. Bye.
Bye.